The BFM Breakfast Grill, connecting you to top people and ideas. Presented by U Mobile.
Good morning, I'm Sharad Kutan, and our guest this morning on The Breakfast Grill is Jeremy Douglas, a regional representative for Southeast Asia and the Pacific at the United Nations Office on Drugs and Crime. Thank you so much for joining us. Sure. I understand that you're here for the Global Illicit Trade Summit. Question is Malaysia a good place to have this conversation?
Oh, most definitely. Malaysia is really at the crossroads of Southeast Asia in many respects. You know, it shares a land border with Thailand, but it also has, it's an archipelago nation sharing borders with Indonesia, other countries. There's a lot of trade going in and out of the country. So this is a prime location really to have a talk about illicit trade and how can we better deal with it.
Yeah, before we get into maybe the conceptual part of the discussion, exactly what is illicit trade as opposed to licit trade or legal trade.
Sure.
The question is the job that you do, do you essentially have a survey of the region? Are you looking primarily at ASEAN nations? And what exactly are you looking at when we talk about illicit trade?
Well, I cover myself. I'm the director for Asia Pacific. So I'm covering from Myanmar to Fiji, believe it or not. But my focus is largely ASEAN countries. And within ASEAN, we focus on the countries that need the help the most. So we're looking really at Laos, Myanmar, Cambodia, Vietnam, the Philippines, when it comes to a lot of the illicit trade or trafficking issues, also Indonesia, Malaysia. But again, for those issues, but different issues, we assess the situation, if you will, and then we target our efforts to help out.
Right. You did mention Singapore, and I'm wondering if is Singapore a shining example of how everything is going right in terms of illicit trade flows in the region? Is that a reason why you didn't mention Singapore?
No. We do work with Singapore, but the work that we do with Singapore is quite different. They're more, because they're essentially almost a city-state, they have the situation, you could say, relatively well under control, but it's easy for them to control borders in and out of Singapore, movements in and out of Singapore. At the same time, Singapore has, it's a high GDP state, so they don't really need the assistance, if you will, of the United Nations to help it out with the various challenges. Where there's a relationship with Singapore is on partnerships, whereby they might participate in conferences that we have and try to speak to their issues, and or they are actually co-hosting things with us to help out other countries. So that's the different relationship.
Perhaps we could begin with that question of definitions. What exactly is illicit trade, and how would you define it against normal or licit trade, especially when we have so many different forms of illicit trade?
Yeah, and there are many forms of illicit trade. So, you know, you have your counterfeit goods, you have things moving through free trade zones that are taxed or not taxed. But our focus at the UN Office on Drugs and Crime is primarily on the more difficult, challenging forms of illicit trade, narcotics, precursor chemicals, which are the chemicals used to make drugs, timber, wildlife, illegal timber, I mean, wildlife, human trafficking, illicit financial flows. So we're looking at all these various issues and then what states may need to do, what institutions in different countries need to be strengthened or helped, either to work together, because these issues are often cross-border, or at a national level, what help do they need to implement their mandate better? So we're looking at this variety of types of illicit trade that I've just mentioned.
You're from the United Nations, which is a global intergovernmental organization.
Yes.
Because there's ASEAN in this region. For a country like Malaysia, if it had the will, if it felt that this was an important issue, would ASEAN be a better place to go to for capacity building, for monitoring, for getting, as it were, the conceptual apparatus all correct in targeting these issues, or the UN?
For solutions, the UN is more the vehicle. For discussion, consensus, agreeing on issues, ASEAN's, in this region, a good vehicle. ASEAN doesn't actually have programs or projects that might help with, you know, say, technical assistance or building capacity and doing research. That's not their role, really. But what ASEAN does do well is get everyone together to talk about challenges they face or issues they want to move forward collectively as a group. What we then do is we participate in those ASEAN meetings often. Then what we'll do is come in behind the ASEAN meeting once they've reached agreement on, say, for example, timber trafficking is a big issue. And 2 years ago, 3 years ago, coincidentally, they did agree that that was an issue they wanted to deal with as a group. Then we come in with programs that will help implement what they've kind of agreed at a high level.
that observers know that there's a lag between the conversation about trade, that everybody's bullish about trade. ASEAN wants to create a community and, you know, an open economic community, and trade, of course, is central to that. But there is, as it said, there's a lag in terms of the public security and that agenda. What happens when you trade, and what gets traded, and perhaps what ought not to be traded?
You're right. The trade agenda is moving very fast in this region through various mechanisms. The ASEAN communities come into force. Some of the countries in the region are part of the TPP. Then you have these special economic zones and free trade zones and so forth being set up around the region to move goods and people and money faster. So that agenda is moving very fast. The public security agenda is and always has been relatively reactive. The challenge we see now in the region is that it's just really lagging, increasingly lagging, in fact. So
the situation is getting worse?
I would say yes. And I would say that it depends on the crime and it depends on the issue. But essentially, the public security agenda is quite far behind the trade agenda. The people that are leading the two discussions, so on the one side, you might have ministries of finance, planning, and trade, and then on the other side, public security, justice, whoever. They're not necessarily talking about joining those two agendas up. So, for example, if you accelerate movement across the border of Malaysia and Thailand multiple times and you don't put in place the systems to manage the border and protect against illicit flows at the same time with the same level of an adequate level of investment, then organized crime can take advantage. They can more quickly move their product as well across that border. And that's what we see happening now in the region.
It was interesting in the discussions that happened at this summit, what was a point that was made about the deep state, that perhaps in certain contexts and with certain crimes or certain goods, individuals or groups of individuals within states might actually be benefiting from these illicit flows. I mean, could you give us a sense of what exactly is happening on the ground? I mean, the magnitude of the problem, the stakeholders, I mean, potentially those are going to prevent these crimes, but also perhaps their complicity in the creation or facilitation of these crimes.
Again, coming back to what we look at, so if we look at the different illicit flows, the biggest one is drugs in this region, remains that. And in fact, we see the drug business evolving, changing, and growing right now. And so there's billions of dollars generated every year. The most of that would be generated in the Golden Triangle. Those billions of dollars have a hugely corrosive, corruptive effect, right? Because people that are in that business can utilize that money, factor in corruption into the business. So those billions of dollars will be moved, and sometimes government officials can be complicit in that because they can be bought off, paid off, whatnot.
And how high would that chain go up? So if you say that individuals, are we just talking about the border guard or the customs official that might be bribed a few, rupiah or baht or whatever? Or are we talking about a chain that goes up, way up into higher levels of government, that people in high places are actually benefiting from these crimes?
We hear that that's the case at high level. It's happening at multiple levels, put it that way. So the frontline border guard who makes $200 a month legitimately may be taking a bribe to allow something to move quickly across the border, turning a blind eye, if you will. Maybe there's a unit commander in a district who's doing the same thing, allowing things to move through his district. And then you might have people at the very high level that are also able to direct operations in such a way that maybe less attention is paid to certain areas or places or people. And that, we understand, does take place. And we've seen occasionally arrests of government officials for involvement in these types of crimes. Very rare, to be honest, but we have seen that.
Are you interested in human trafficking? Is that something that comes within your ambit?
Yes. We are, in the UN system, the lead on the public security and justice response when it comes to human trafficking. There's a variety of ways you can look at trafficking, like labor markets. But when it comes to those, the trafficking, like the hardcore trafficking, that's our mandate.
Maybe at this point in time, just make mention of that Wang Kalian case that happened on the Malaysian Thai border. We looked, and you know what the Malaysian media noted was that the Thai side seemed to have had a huge number of arrests, and they were quite high level individuals within the command structure of border control and such. Not so on the Malaysian side. I mean, when you look at a situation like Wang Kalian and the kind of asymmetry in response between Thailand and Malaysia, what's your sense of what's going on there?
Well, the Thais felt a huge amount of pressure to enact some changes. And so there was a massive amount of resources poured at that investigation, which did lead to, as you point out, very senior command. In fact, military commanders. There's one in prison now for human trafficking. So that did take place. I can't really speak to what happened so much on the Malaysia side, although I did note that as a reaction to that, Malaysia instituted a national task force, interagency task force on human trafficking, which I think the Minister of Home Affairs announced.
We're very good at having task force.
This one, I must say, you're right. And I think that's an issue for the region. A lot of task forces out there. I must say, though, this particular task force has actually worked in the sense that we've got we're part of it. Multiple parts of government came together to address human trafficking and do joint operations, which previously they weren't doing. So at least we now know that that's taking place.
I'm speaking to Jeremy Douglas, Regional Representative for Southeast Asia and the Pacific at the United Nations Office on Drugs and Crime. Next up, we talk about free trade zones and how they fit into the illicit trade scenario. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9.
You are listening to the BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U-Mobile.
Good morning. If you just joined us, I'm Sharad Kutan, and my guest on the Breakfast Grill today is Jeremy Douglas, Regional Representative for Southeast Asia and the Pacific at the United Nations Office on Drugs and Crime. He's here for the Global Illicit Trade Summit organized by The Economist. Well, let's talk about the free trade zones, because it was part of the conversation here. Mm-hmm. Very interesting, because they're often seen as a way in which developing nations facilitate industrialization. This is seen mm-hmm. as a way of, you know, enticing foreign investment. Mm-hmm. But in the story that was being told at this summit, it seems also to facilitate all kinds of not so great things. And maybe you could help us understand, why is it that free trade zones have come in for some attention, especially in relation to illicit trade?
You're right. They've proliferated across the region, if you will. And for exactly the reasons you mentioned, the governments are looking for ways to juice up economic activity. Often they build them around ports, or they build them around airports, key infrastructure which will allow movement in and out. Our concern with these free trade zones is the variability in policies to manage them, the capacities. Sometimes they have very lax controls around them, which allow things to move in and out with very minimal inspection. And that could be both goods, that could be money as well. So with that kind of environment that's being created, which is meant to provide a very, very low regulation business-friendly environment, also we're seeing criminal risks.
Do you have specific cases that will help us illustrate the problem? And I think in the conversations that were held at the summit, you mentioned Singapore in this regard. You were talking about the flows of goods through Singapore that in fact ended up being discovered to be illicit and illegal goods.
Well, the comment that was made earlier was really about the port. And Chris, the host of the panel as well, had highlighted this, and he's highlighted it in some of the research that they've done. Basically, we have seen examples of things that have gone through that port. You have to look at Singapore in the global context. It's competing with other ports around the world to be a bigger port, to move more containers, shipping containers through it, because there's revenue associated with all the ships coming in and with all of the movement. We have seen examples. We've actually know that there was containers that entered from Singapore that came from somewhere else, mind you. They came to Singapore, then through Singapore, then to Myanmar, that contained, of all things, drugs. Usually drugs aren't coming out of Myanmar, but usually they're coming out, not going in. But in this case, there was a kind of a swap arrangement with one criminal organization and another, and drugs came through into that country, very oddly. A particular kind of drug that's not common here is cocaine. But the point being that the container just sailed through. It did have suspicious signs associated with the container, but when it got to Myanmar, it was found to contain this drug.
Is it about dereliction of duty? Is somebody in Singapore, in this instance, not doing something, or is it that they're not even asked to do it?
My understanding is the latter. So it's more or less that they're trying to move things through as quickly as possible. So this container, the ultimate end destination was Myanmar, but the idea being that it would move through as quickly as possible. Our understanding of the processes in the port is that they weren't looking for risks that would be associated with trafficking, for example. They just allowed it to move through. Whereas on the other end, it was found randomly, by the way, to contain this substance. That's one indication of what can take place. But again, in that global context, they're competing with Dubai, they're competing with other locations that also have mass container movements.
So what is it you have to say to a public official to persuade them to do something, because they will say, well, you know, look, my country is only facilitating this. We're benefiting from it. If it's illicit, okay, that might be a problem ultimately. But, you know, in the near term, that's okay. And, you know, there's a lot of transshipment of goods coming, say, for instance, from China. You know, China re-exports stuff so that it can... Yes. You know, it can avoid certain trade issues on countries they're exporting to. They export through Malaysia. You know, nobody sees it necessarily as a problem. After all, Malaysians are getting something from this.
Right.
How do you persuade a public official that ultimately this is not a good thing?
Well, I think when we discuss the context of transnational crime connected to trade, we do see kind of an analogy, a light bulb go off. Right. We need to deal with this a little bit differently. Increasingly, there's an acknowledgement that we're bound together as a region, but also that the public security challenges are binding the region together as well. So there is starting to be a bit of a discussion at the policy level that there's a need to deal with these things more collectively and better. So there's starting to be that discussion. We're not there yet, though, I have to be honest with you. There's still the people want things moving through fast are winning the argument at the moment.
And they're winning the argument because it's the bottom line is so compelling.
Yeah, the bottom line is, in the financial sense, is what they're after at the moment. So what we need is more focus on stopping the bad stuff coming through without disrupting the bottom line, mind you.
So maybe governments are inclined to trot out those platitudes about dealing with the drug problem. We see often mules being caught. We don't see the big guys being caught or the people organizing it, these flows. What do you ultimately see, you know, the region in the next 10 years, for instance? Do you think we can really stamp out the flows of hard drugs? Who doesn't want this stopped? I mean, apart from the criminal gangs.
Well, at the moment... the data are telling us that we've seen an expansion of the regional drug market for a decade now. And it's continuing to expand, and we're seeing a consolidation of the business into certain parts of the region. For example, the Golden Triangle, Myanmar particularly, we're seeing a consolidation of the business there in very alarming ways. Very large transnational organized crime groups are working with ethnic armed groups or armed rebel armies there to produce large volumes of narcotics which are being trafficked across the region. Unless the region gets together to really seriously, collectively address this, which at the moment there is no regional policy or plan in place. There's kind of a quasi-policy plan, but there's not really one on the table that I could show you. Then the environment is still there to allow this business to grow. So it will continue to grow until they agree that they want it dealt with. And that means top-level leadership need to put it on their agenda.
Are criminal gangs, you know, in position, in any part of the region, likely to capture the state? I mean, are we looking at the possibility of a narco state developing or a state, you know, that facilitates all kinds of crimes because the political leadership, the elite, essentially now, arm in arm with criminal organizations?
That's a really... You know,
I know you're from the UN, but can you name a country?
I honestly can't name a country where you were going to see complete state capture. What I could say, though, is that we see parts of certain countries where we see strong indications of capture of part of a state, right, by organized criminal groups or armed groups that are essentially now merged with criminal groups. So I use the example of Myanmar. There's this area in northern Myanmar called the Special Regions, which are in Shan State. They're completely autonomous from the central government. They operate their own governments. They have their own armies. And those places allow all of this business to flourish. We also see some of these economic zones, for example, in Laos, Special Economic Zone, which has recently been flagged by the U.S. Treasury as being run by organized crime. So that's an autonomous part within that country. There's not a state that's been captured, but we could say there's some small geographic points of problems.
Myanmar, of course, prime example, partly because of the weakness of state formation there, still not consolidated itself as a state. What about we look at, say, the rise of the Islamic State in Southeast Asia? Any link between that kind of terrorist organization and perhaps illicit trade? Because we also learned about the way in which terrorist organizations tax illicit trade or even legitimate trade in order to fund their politics.
Yeah. We do see, obviously, a correlation between transnational organized crime money flows and terrorist activities, including within this region. It's clearly not on the scale of what we saw in the Middle East, and the governments of this region have capacities and are much more aware that this is a problem than what we saw in the Middle East. So I don't think we're at that point of saying we're going to see a state or part of a state captured by a terrorist organization. After Marwari, we obviously the concern is there, and the heightened awareness is there. So the governments are really trying to target, or I should say, collectively get together to deal with this.
All right, Marwari City in the Philippines.
Yes, correct, yeah.
Thank you so much for being with us this morning.
Pleasure.
I've been speaking to Jeremy Douglas, Regional Representative for Southeast Asia and the Pacific at the United Nations Office on Drugs and Crime. I'm Shaurya Kutan, and this has been The Breakfast Grill on BFM 89.9, The Business Station.
That episode of BFM Breakfast Grill was brought to you by U-Mobile, where data hearts you.